Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. I'm your host, John Tanza, on this live broadcast from Washington. Here are some of the top stories making news across Sudan, South Sudan, and the rest of Africa this Monday, December 30, 2024. Former U.S. President Jimmy Carter, who died on Sunday, worked for the people of Sudan and South Sudan.
Also, it's been afflicted, you know, for off and on for the last 25 years with a terrible war. And so, in the midst of combat, then our volunteers are reluctant to go into some of the villages that are still involved in conflict.
And Kenyans are back on the street demanding for change. We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Former President Jimmy Carter has died at the age of 100. VOA's Ken Farabao extensively covered the former president's life and post-presidential career, promoting global health and democracy, and has more on the legacy of the 39th president of the United States.
I, Jimmy Carter, do solemnly swear.
When Jimmy Carter took the oath of office on January 20th, 1977, he promised a government as good as its people.
There can be no nobler, no more ambitious task for America to undertake on this day of a new beginning than to help shape a just and peaceful world.
A world he continued to shape beyond his single term in the White House, becoming a Nobel Peace Prize laureate, heading the global nonprofit, the Carter Center, whose mission is waging peace, fighting disease, and building hope.
I look upon the Carter Center work as an extension of what I try to do as president.
Carter was born in Plains, Georgia in 1924. He graduated from the U.S. Naval Academy in 1946, serving as a submarine officer before returning to Plains in 1953 to run the family farm in the wake of his father's death. Carter entered politics during the civil rights movement of the 1960s, serving two terms as a Georgia legislator before becoming the state's governor in 1971.
I say to you quite frankly that the time for racial discrimination is over.
Carter went from being an unknown Southern governor in 1971 to the winning presidential candidate in 1976, narrowly defeating Republican Gerald Ford. Mediating the 1979 Camp David Accords and the eventual peace treaty between Egypt and Israel was the pinnacle of Carter's presidency.
There had been four wars between Arabs and Israelis in the previous 25 years, with the Egyptians and the leadership supported by the Soviet Union. They were the only country that could really challenge Israel militarily.
Carter also negotiated a treaty returning control of the Panama Canal to Panama and established full diplomatic ties with the People's Republic of China. But the 1979 Islamic Revolution in Iran would change the course of his presidency. Protests led by Shiite clerics toppled the U.S.-backed Shah, who fled the country. Militants later stormed the U.S. Embassy in Tehran, taking 66 Americans hostage. In late November of that year, 13 hostages were released. In April 1980, Carter authorized a military operation to free the remaining hostages. It failed, and eight U.S. service members died. Carter also faced challenges at home. Inflation and rising unemployment hobbled the economy, contributing to his 1980 election defeat to Republican Ronald Reagan. On January 20th, 1981, Reagan's inauguration day, Iran finally freed the American hostages. Carter, defeated and depressed, returned to Plains to plan his presidential library.
I envisioned to be a tiny thing where I would have an office and some nice buildings in Atlanta.
It became much more. A well-known global nonprofit, the Carter Center has monitored over 100 elections and mediated disputes ranging from a nuclear standoff with North Korea in 1994 to a peace agreement between Uganda and Sudan. The center also promotes health and fights illness in the poorest parts of the planet. Eradicating guinea worm disease has been a primary goal.
There's only been one disease in the history of humankind ever eradicated, and that was smallpox, more than 30 years ago. So guinea worm is going to soon be the second disease in history to be wiped off the face of the earth.
Carter's work helping humanity led to Oslo, Norway in 2002, where he accepted the Nobel Peace Prize.
When I won the Nobel Peace Prize, for instance, it was because of the work of the Carter Center. So I would be perfectly satisfied to have a legacy based on peace and human rights. I mean, who would?
Carter led an active life into his 90s, surviving brain cancer in 2015. But declining health and the 2020 global coronavirus pandemic kept him confined to his hometown of Plains in his final years. In one of his last public media appearances, Carter shared with VOA his hopes for the future.
Well, I would like to see the United States in the future strive to be the number one champion in the world of peace and human rights and environmental equality. And I would say treating everybody equal. If we could do that, we'd have a real superpower in the country that I love very much.
Carter lived the longest of any occupant of the White House, and his 76-year marriage to wife Rosalynn is the longest of any president and first lady. Kane Farbaugh, VOA News, Plains, Georgia.
Jimmy Carter, the 39th president of the United States and the winner of the 2002 Nobel Peace Prize, died peacefully Sunday, December 29, at his home in Plains, Georgia. VOA's Yehia Wehub interviewed President Carter in 2014, and they discussed the situation in Sudan and South Sudan.
No, the internally displaced people are in northern Sudan, in the 15 states in the north, and there are no guinea worm cases now in northern Sudan. All the remaining guinea worm cases in Sudan are in South Sudan. And the latest figures I have on that, we know that there are 1,368 cases, 1,368 cases in Sudan, in southern Sudan. And in all the other states combined, that is in Ghana and Mali and Ethiopia, all of them put together only 36 cases. So you see that almost all of the cases now left in southern Sudan.
The south of the country is, as you know, Mr. President, largely underdeveloped and also has relatively little governmental or public health infrastructure. How does this affect efforts to detect and control guinea worm?
Well, it makes it more difficult, and that's probably why we've got southern Sudan as the last place. Also, it's been afflicted, you know, off and on for the last 25 years with a terrible war. And so in the midst of combat, then our volunteers are reluctant to go into some of the villages that are still involved in conflict. And that's a problem for us now because we have some of those villages that still have guinea worm. Our people are can't go in there because their bicycles or their pickup trucks or motor scooters are stolen, and they are intimidated because of violence.
So you mentioned this terrible war in Sudan.
Yes.
What effect does civil strife have on controlling the disease?
Well, it's intimidating to our workers, and it makes it almost impossible for us to send in, say, 10 people to work in a village if they're afraid for their lives or if they ride bicycles in and they know the bicycles are going to be stolen from them. And when you have armed soldiers going back and forth through those villages, harassing people and maybe raping their women. So it makes it very difficult for us to get volunteers or even our paid employees to go into troubled places that are still involved in conflict.
Can you describe any cooperative efforts you've had with the central government in Khartoum or with the government in the south to control the disease?
We've had almost perfect cooperation from the government in Khartoum from the very beginning. So we were very quick and successful in eradicating in eliminating guinea worm from the 15 northern states. And, of course, for a long time, almost all the war in Sudan was concentrated in the south. Now there's an uneasy ceasefire. And we have a very good working relationship with the president of the south, Salva Kiir. And, of course, he requires his minister of health and others to cooperate with us as well. So in the last 5 years, we've had very good support from the government in South Sudan.
That's Jimmy Carter, 39th president of the United States and winner of the 2002 Nobel Peace Prize, who died peacefully Sunday, December 29, at his home in Plains. He spoke with VOA's Yehia Wehub in 2014.
VOA Africa is your trusted source for news, sports, entertainment, and music. Stay engaged with VOA Africa. We love to hear your voice. call us 24/7 on WhatsApp and leave a message. Leave comments, requests, or greetings. We may play your message on VOA Africa. Dial the international code +1, then 202-258-3076. VOA Africa is always happy to hear your voice. The number again is the international code +1, then 202-258-3076.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. A Nigerian foreign affairs expert says former U.S. President Jimmy Carter was Africa-friendly during his lifetime. Dr. Nicholas Idris is a senior research fellow and head of the Division of International Politics at the Nigerian Institute of International Affairs in Lagos. He tells reporter Mike Bonye that Carter's work as president and after he left the White House benefited several African countries.
In 1978, he masterminded the famous Camp David Accord, the signing of the peace treaty between Egypt and Israel. And also, his foundation, Jimmy Carter Foundation, assisted lots and lots of African countries, including Nigeria, to eradicate Guinea worm. Your take on this, sir?
Yeah, you see, one thing about the Camp David Accord between Israel and Egypt, it was significant in the sense that it was historic in that the agreement itself led to the first Israeli-Arab peace treaty. And if you look at what has been happening since that accord and what you have contemporary now, you know that if not for the efforts of people like Jimmy Carter, perhaps there have been more crises in the Arab region between Arab and Israeli. Even though the crises have still continued to persist, thank God, I mean, we can say it's a good thing that Jimmy Carter was able to strike out that accord because it continues to be a reference point to any issues about how to address the conflict or resolving the conflict within that region. It was not just timely, it was also significant. And don't also forget that that itself was the accord that also earned him the 2002 Nobel laureate. Yes. So in terms of being the American president and in terms of the American foreign policy, which was already nosediving at that period, that accord was very, very timely because, one, it helped to boost his candidacy. I mean, it helped to boost his personality, one, even the American foreign policy, and it was also useful, you know, in addressing long-standing conflicts in the Arab Israeli world.
And what about the Guinea worm eradication sponsored by Jimmy Carter Foundation?
My personal observation about him is that he seems to have, acted or performed so much in his post-presidency period as compared to his period within his presidency. And what this means is that apart from his legacies in the U.S. about issues about economy, energy security, and social justice and equality and everything, in terms of post-presidency and how what Africans should do, in terms of contribution to Africa, you see, first, he was very much involved in the issues about addressing what they call pandemics, like guinea worms and other issues, one. And he had a whole lot of foundations that were really saddled with the responsibilities of helping Africa, Nigeria, and other countries, you know, to fight this guinea worm and other things. And he also had some other NGOs that focused about bringing about educations, and this not to also forget about his impact and his influence on conflict prevention, peacekeeping, and crisis management across Africa, Nigeria, and the rest of the globe. So it is one of the good things that he was strong enough to marshal that position to ensure that he had so many NGOs, foundations, and donations that were in charge of, you know, addressing these issues, particularly the issues about guinea worm in Nigeria, because we must accept the fact that that itself went a long way in ensuring that guinea worm itself was brought to a standstill in Nigeria.
Some analysts say former President Jimmy Carter was Africa-friendly and that under his tenure, Africa enjoyed the U.S. There was this harmonious relationship between U.S. and Africa. Do you think Africa will miss the former U.S. president?
In foreign policy, we always discuss the role of personality. And that is not to say that every other regime has not benefited Africa. On a one-on-one basis, Jimmy Carter had the African as his project, as his personal project. So he was so much focused on a person-to-person interaction in Africa, and he was so much focused on what Africa can be, how Africa was going to lift up from its current predicament into being a global power to be reckoned with. So, and it was no longer surprising how and where he continued to ensure that most of those NGOs were focused around working in Africa. So, you like it or not, many people in Africa liked him so much because of his open diplomacy, because of his open hand negotiations, because of his open door policy of interacting with Africa. So I think that in his death, Africa also lost a friend.
That's Nicola Idris, a senior fellow and head of Division of International Politics at the Nigerian Institute of International Affairs in Lagos. He spoke with reporter Mike Bonye. You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, Kenyans march back to the streets. Find out why after the break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what skill would you most like to master?
I would love to learn how to use my hands, that is craft work, making the baskets and doing more of the clay artwork.
So I think I will go technology any day, anytime. So mastering what I do already, which is practically technology, which is software development, applications development, analysis and data mining.
I would love to play the organ. I love it. I love the sound. I would want to have it at home to play to my family.
Now many people don't like to be teachers. So for me, I'm willing to be.
I appreciate people that I can sing because I can't sing myself and I don't have a very good voice. So I will go for singing.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
This is Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. The situation remains tense in much of Kenya following fresh protests by young adults, members of the Generation Z. The protests are against the government's failure to identify, arrest and prosecute those responsible for a series of abductions and disappearances of government critics. From Nairobi, reporter James Shimanyola has more.
In the Kenyan capital, Nairobi, police on horseback fired tear gas canisters at protesters Monday. Human rights groups, victims and activists say security agents wearing masks and dark glasses have used unmarked cars to abduct more than 100 unarmed young critics of the government since June. The Kenyan government has denied it was responsible. According to human rights groups, more than 60 protesters have been killed in the protests. In June, thousands of protesters took to the streets across Kenya to oppose legislation to sharply raise taxes in an effort to cut the national debt. After weeks of often violent protests, President William Ruto abandoned the legislation and said he would engage more with the public to find a way forward. Kasmueli Makoure is a leader of the Kenya Youth Group and one of the country's prominent activists.
Now what we are on the streets to demand is Ruto must go. It is very clear clarion call that we will not tolerate this system. This system most definitely will not work for us. We are on the streets to overhaul the entire system. Let that not be mistaken for anarchy.
Shakira Wafula is a member of Generation Z.
Occupy everywhere, because young people disappearing are from all walks of life, are from different areas in the country.
Lisa Sari is another demonstrator.
I don't want to hide the fact that I am one of the Gen Z members. Looking at the way young people have been kidnapped and disappeared without trace, it looks like the abductors will finish us. That's why we are protesting today.
Kenya law professor and regular commentator on social issues Patrick Lumumba says the protests may get worse.
There is a volcano that is still waiting to erupt and erupt positively. The Gen Zs, they are back with a bang and doing the thing that we thought they would stop doing, and that is sad.
Political analysts and social observers in Kenya have described the protests as the biggest since the country's independence 61 years ago. For VOA Africa, this is James Shimanyula in Nairobi.
We're bringing women's voices to the conversation on things that matter to hearts and minds of women.
We are here at Kalerwe Market in Uganda, Kampala, where in this whole market, women are crying out for their situations to change.
With strong opinions and expertise on things that impact and change their lives.
Here in Kinshasa, campaigns to raise awareness against the spread of coronavirus are common, but getting that information to people who have no access to water, electricity, or money can be a challenge.
From right here in the nation's capital to on the ground from all over the African continent.
I think a big thing for me is just being able to say that when these protests are happening, does it turn around into policy?
We hear your voices, women's voices, our voices, and add your voice to the conversation each week right here on The Voice of America. Check your local TV listings.
Hi, I'm Larry London, and I welcome you to Border Crossings, where we play requests and dedications during the week. But on Tuesday, something special, the music feature of the week. It's our spotlight artist, and this coming up Tuesday, we have From China to Appalachia. They are going to join us. They were ravaged recently in the hurricane, and they're here to talk to us about it, China to Appalachia. And they're joining us on Border Crossings at 1500 Universal on The Voice of America.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. And as we approach the end of the year, we would like to give you an opportunity to send greetings to your loved ones. You can record your greetings. Our number is +1 202 630 8011. That's our WhatsApp number, +1 202 630 8011. Record your greetings, send your greetings to your loved ones, and we will air them on Wednesday, January 1st, 2025. That's all we prepared for you this Monday, December 30th, 2024. We now leave you with some traditional Baka song from Maridi County in Western Equatorial State.
I'm not
We have been listening to some traditional Baka song from my village in Maridi County. I am allowed to play my traditional song once in a while. I'm your host, John Tanza, on this live broadcast from Studio 14 here in Washington. On behalf of our team, Mokbul Yabaru, and engineer Dan Brady, we wish you a lovely evening. Remember to join us tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
As Secretary of State Antony Blinken said recently, this has not been a good year for Iran. Its primary proxies, Hezbollah and Hamas, have been decimated. Its closest state ally, the Assad regime in Syria, has collapsed. Iran's missiles have been proven ineffective. Many of its air defenses have been destroyed. Weakened though it may be, the Iranian regime continues to wield a strong and repressive hand against the Iranian people, especially those who have raised their voices in dissent or provided accurate news and information. One such example occurred in December when journalist Reza Velizadeh, a dual U.S.-Iranian citizen, was sentenced to 10 years in prison on charges of collaborating with a hostile government. Velizadeh had worked for U.S.-funded Radio Farda, an outlet of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, and sister station of the Voice of America. He left there in 2022 and worked in a variety of Farsi language outlets. Reza Velizadeh returned to Iran to visit family in February 2024 and was arrested in late September. During his two court sessions in November, no prosecution representative was present. Instead, the judge assumed that role. In addition to his 10-year prison sentence, Velizadeh was also sentenced to a 2-year travel ban and other penalties. He is currently in Evin prison and reportedly has been denied visiting rights. At a press briefing, State Department spokesperson Matthew Miller strongly condemned Velizadeh's sentencing and called for his immediate release and the release of all political prisoners in Iran.
The Iranian government has repeatedly suppressed press freedom through threats, intimidation, detentions, forced confessions, and the use of violence against journalists in Iran.
The 2024 Press Freedom Index, published by Reporters Without Borders, ranks Iran number 176 out of 180 countries assessed. The assessment shows that Iran is continuing to keep up its reputation as one of the most repressive countries in the world in terms of freedom of the press. In his recent statement on the ancient festival of Shab-e Yalda, when Iranians celebrate the longest night of the year, spokesperson Miller said, "On this Shab-e Yalda, we reaffirm our support for the Iranian people. Their courage in the face of repression and their unwavering pursuit of freedom inspires the world. We stand with them in their struggle, knowing that the dawn of a brighter future will come."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.